This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Bret Easton Ellis. He's the author, most recently, of the novel Lunar Park, the author as well of Less Than Zero, The Rules of Attraction, The Informers, and Glamorama. Now, in this new novel, he's combined a horror novel with, well, I would say that the narrator, who is Bret Easton Ellis, is haunted by himself, and that the book is about the haunted house within the haunted house of consciousness within the haunted house of a horror movie. And the book is about the vibrations that occur when one is put in the context of the other. It's almost as if an actual person is CGI'd into a haunted house, and what happens around him becomes the reflection of his internal set of preoccupations. Tell me about how it came to be written.
Well, in 1989, after I'd finished American Psycho, I had two ideas for novels that were fluttering around. One was to write a book that was an homage to the comic books that I loved as a kid, specifically the EC comic books like Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror, and as well as the more modern Warren comics, which were eerie and creepy, and Vampirilla. Those were the three main ones that I remembered a lot, as well as an homage to Stephen King, who at that time was my favorite writer, as he was probably every other teenage boy in America in the 70s and 80s. And so I wanted to write a book that, reminded me of all the pleasure that I got from those sources, as well as countless B-movies that I watched during that period as well. But I didn't feel that I was ready to write that book yet. I didn't feel that I had the chops to pull it off. So instead, I wrote Glamorama, which was still on the same beat as what I'd been doing, up until then. It wasn't a big departure. I mean, it was about a world that I knew fairly well, and there was a character that was much closer to my age than the father in Lunar Park. And so after I finished Glamorama, I decided, well, I'm ready for Lunar Park. I did have a problem, though. I had some kind of block. I couldn't get through all of the notebooks and all the outlines I had made up of Lunar Park over the years when I sat down to write the novel, because I was having problems with the main character. I wasn't quite getting him. And then suddenly, out of the blue, it occurred to me that, well, he was me, and why not go all out and just make the character Bret Ellis? And that's how it started.
How did it change when you put yourself at the center of it?
Well, it was changing before I even realized I was going to be put at the center of it. If I had began the outline for Lunar Park in 1989, various things happened to me over the next 10 years or so that began to get incorporated into this very long outline for this book, specifically the publication of American Psycho and the very mixed feelings I had about creating this character, Patrick Bateman. And that intensified, actually, as the novel gained in popularity over the 90s. And soon there were, people. I would be in New York and I'd see dozens of Patrick Batemans at the Halloween parade, and there were Patrick Bateman websites and people wanting to be Patrick Bateman, et cetera, and which also I think the movie helped, explode that as well. And then my father died in 1992, and I realized that part of this haunting was going to be due to the main character's unresolved feelings about his father. And that was not necessarily in the first draft of an outline for this book. And also, ultimately, right before I began writing Lunar Park, I realized that the act of writing was a subject in itself. And I became very interested in writing about the process of writing. So those, I think, were the three main things that changed Lunar Park from 1989 to when I finally finished it in September of 2004.
Now, I feel like this book is genuinely a crazy book in the way in which, at the end of Lady from Shanghai, although you're in a fun house in a hall of mirrors, they keep calling it the crazy house. And you really do feel in that film, as you're watching all the glass shatter, that something's happened that's shattering the panes here. And it seems as if, you talk about unresolved feelings, it seems as if putting yourself in this haunted house provides an assault on ambivalent feelings of all kinds toward parenthood, toward childhood, toward sexuality, almost as if this is going to be a pressure cooker book for the character, the novelist, to walk out from alive.
Well, then that's part of the suspense of the book, I guess. I mean, when you enter into this book and you slowly begin to realize, as the reader, what these forces want from this character, well, yeah, you should be worried and you should be fearful of this guy and what's going to happen to him. And but as for myself, I mean, again, there does come a shift when you're writing a book, and no matter how autobiographical it is, where, you know, your craft kicks in and you really tend not to identify so heavily with your narrator, and you just become worried about the writing itself and the prose and the message that the prose is giving, and that the waves of feeling your sentence structure is giving out. I've already dealt with all the emotional aspects of the novel and all of my mixed feelings about being the narrator and all my unresolved feelings about, you know, my dad and Patrick Bateman, etc., before I start writing the book. That's taken care of in the outline. So I have a pretty clear head when I'm working on this book, and it's kind of at a distance from me during the 4 years that it took to write it.
But it does feel as if from time to time that distance gets violated. I'm talking in general, I suppose. But I think that in, for instance, The Lady from Shanghai, which is another instance of shattered narrative, and you're watching Orson Welles, who one knows was married to Rita Hayworth, and you know, horrible things are happening. There's a character with prosthesis, there's constant castration imagery. You don't feel, however much in control of technique Welles is, and we know he is, that the mixture between technique and control is going to survive the laceration of being looked at in this way, especially with a plot like Lady from Shanghai or like Lunar Park, that we all know the plot is being made to break something apart, to break up some kind of arctic flow, it seems to me.
I guess so. I mean, again, going back, I was still in love with the idea of a genre book. It did alter wildly when it began to become apparent to me that it was going to be, a lot of my life was going to be in it. And once I decided the narrator was going to be Brett Easton Ellis, yeah, it shattered that, you know, sort of perfect B-movie sensibility that I was so in love with, or the comic book sensibility or the Stephen King sensibility that I really wanted to recapture quite faithfully. Maybe give it a bit of a postmodern spin like I did with the spy novels, for example, that I loved and which I kind of deconstructed in Glamorama. But I really was going to write a very heartfelt homage to these books I loved. But that did crack open when I brought myself into it. It really did alter the material a lot. And I'm glad it did. I think it makes the book, I don't know, certainly more driven, more interesting, I guess. And it also made it, you know, on a selfish level, much more, much, you know, easier to write.
Now, you talk about in the book certain things that get boring, and the resolution of mystery in particular is one of those things that you know a writer needs to avoid. So that in this book, there are mysteries that are solved, but other mysteries underneath them that have to be sustained. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, I think there's at one point near the end of the books, someone is told that in response to them asking why did these things happen, that, you know, ultimately in art, explanations are boring. And I have to agree with that. I do think mystery is much more gripping and riveting than answers. And especially when you're working within a genre like mystery or horror novels, the explanations are always the biggest letdown. They arrive in the end somehow, and they're always they never quite are as satisfying as the scares and the jolts you get as you're moving through a book. And I think that last chapter, where explanations are kind of given to some of the more disturbing mysteries, well, I think more mysteries then emerge from those answers. And so I was okay with that, but I think it was just a given of the material that some of these things had to be answered or not.
A given, but at the same time, there's a scene, for instance, when the Ghostbuster Robert Miller notices that the toy, it's a kind of satanic spinoff of a Furby named Termy. It spells Y Brett backwards. And, you know, if we're reading, we think about Red Brum and The Shining. And, you know, it's a moment that's practically just twirled like a frisbee. You know, there's no weight to it whatsoever. But there, at the same time, there are currents in the book that do feel weighty and disturbing and perplexing. Do you really mean that you have thought these things through? Because, you know, after all, you're playing with eatable things and Hamlet things. When you stir these things up, there's an inevitable muddying, it seems to me.
Yeah, I guess there is, but that's interesting to me.
Yes, of course. That's what I mean. That if it were just technique or the demands of the form, it wouldn't be a very interesting book.
Yeah, but I guess I deal with all of that stuff again before I start writing the book, and all that stuff that is very complicated and muddied and, I don't know, nuts is dealt with for me emotionally before I begin writing the book. I think that's what I'm saying. So when I'm dealing with this brew of, you know, all these disparate elements, I'm able to just lay them out very calmly and matter-of-factly, and it doesn't really I'm not thinking that when I'm working on the book.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Brett Easton Ellis, author most recently of Lunar Park, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brett Easton Ellis about his new novel, Lunar Park. It seems as if these deconstructions are required to center on the unanswerable questions, so that in Glamorama, for instance, the unanswerable questions about spies is of their commitment and their sexuality. Does it have any weight beyond its immediate moment of intrigue? In this book, the question becomes, you know, what weight, other than decoration for the Gothic, does the family have? These books blow up the ghosts of the past. They involve, you know, the return of the father, or the return of the repressed, every other kind of return. So the question becomes, in a deconstruction, what lasts? What makes the form persist?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that we're all haunted by, you know, death, and that people have people very close to us who have either failed us or have loved us very much die, and you are forever haunted by that loss. And so ultimately, I think that's why ghost stories and horror novels really do have this primal impact on audiences, because it just they just locate that thing that no one is ever going to be able to, you know, shake off, no matter how, I don't know, no matter sophisticated you are, no matter how religious you are, whatever. I mean, it's still, these things are going to always haunt you. So that lasts, that feeling lasts, and that really is what infuses novels. It's all about loss, horror novels. I mean, they really are all about loss and grappling with it, and how this loss takes forms. I mean, in this book, I mean, the loss takes fairly violent forms. The son becomes the father, and the father's demons infect the son, and the son acts them out in a family very much like the family and even the house that his father inhabited when he was a boy. So that kind of thing is, I don't know, that's a very powerful thing. Much more so than the monsters and beasts that run around and scare people and the boo moments. Though, of course, there's something, you know, to take comfort in that in a way. But I think it's a sense of loss that that always just stays and is powerful.
You know, in Joan Didion's new book, The Year of Magical Thinking, she says that she suddenly realized after her husband's death that she could not bring herself to give away his clothing because she felt, she believed, that he was going to be coming back and that she would be betraying him if there weren't clothes for him, if he happened to arrive at this house or the other house or the office or the apartment. And she realized that she had entered what she hates most of all, thinking that goes counter to reality, clarity, and logic. And I think that the haunted house narrative is the romance of the other side, asking you to think that all of it is possible. They can come back. They can ask us for what they wanted. And we're going to be forced by them, in addition, being able to say the things that they couldn't say to us directly in life.
But they do come back. See, this is the problem. I mean, they come back involuntarily. You find yourself talking to them. You find yourself suddenly thinking about them when a song comes on the radio that they really liked, or when you see someone who resembles them, and when you're sitting in a restaurant and you're kind of like jolted by that and disturbed, and it kind of, you kind of crane your neck the rest of the evening looking at this person. So, I mean, I think you always are, regardless. And I'm not talking about, you know, phantoms materializing in front of you, but on a different, more realistic level, yeah, you are always haunted, and it's not going to go away. No matter how rational you are, you know, there's always these remnants of these people who have meant something to you and who are gone that kind of force you into a state that you had always denied, whereas I believe in science. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in the, you know, materialization of spirits. Well, ultimately, that all does exist. It does exist on a certain level. All of these things happen. And it's your mind, you know, playing whatever tricks on you or wanting you to connect with that person who's gone. So I think it's unavoidable.
Do you think, or rather I'll do it my way, I think that the cheesiness and the cliches of horror novels help make them so effective, that they're part and parcel of why they work. And I know people think about it in other ways, that they're poetic despite their, you know, rickety and hoary devices. But I think the manipulation of cliches in such a relentless fashion brings you into a very vulnerable place, so that you can be a kind of attacked, because there's nothing as potent as a still vital cliche. They've lasted for a reason.
Yeah, and they're also fun, and they also are, they give you pleasure because you remember them when you were younger, and even in that, I mean, they have meaning then. So at least for me as a writer, when I'm working on something, I mean, I do want to enjoy myself as much as I can, and those things give me great solace. So you know, everything from the very worried dog, family dog, who's barking around the edges of the house, to a misbehaving toy, to I don't know, moans coming from the field in the backyard. I like all of that.
Well, I particularly like those things that seem to sew up, because that dog is quite troublesome in the book, and it's mentioned that the dead father used to beat the dog. So it feels as if Victor has a justified complaint in this book.
Well, he certainly has a hard time. I think, you know, maybe one of the relationships that's really the most most things at stake are between the family golden retriever and Brett Easton Ellis in this. They really do not get along very well at all, and increasingly so until I think I guess all hell breaks loose near the end.
Do you have a favorite of those devices?
I liked, I always was really scared by, like, dolls coming alive. And I always was frightened of, I never had any. I never had, like, you know, stuffed animals or anything like that. They didn't really necessarily interest me, but my sisters did when I was growing up. And I found many of them really creepy and scary. And also, you know, clown toys, you know, the usual litany, you know. And so definitely I was thinking of that when I created this thing, the Turby, the doll that the youngest daughter has, and how it malfunctions all the time. And so, yeah, that's definitely one of them, the possessed doll cliche.
Because I've wondered, you know, as these impedimenta and paraphernalia mounted up in the book, it seemed like a version of that old television show, To Tell the Truth. Will the real so-and-so please stand up? Eventually, we're asking questions like, who is really being haunted? Brett Easton Ellis, his son, the house itself. And, you know, it's as if these are all being gathered as suspects in the ultimate haunting. And our job is going to be to brush aside the toys and the infernal machines and let the ghosts really rage.
Well, yeah, that's what the book is leading to, and that's, you know, that's the penultimate sequence in the book, and that's where really everything begins to become, quote-unquote, explained to a degree, to not only Ellis, but also to the reader as well. But yeah, I think, you need all of those things. You need all this structure. You need the structure of the Haunted House novel, and all of its trappings and all of its tricks to finally get to a place like that. No matter how fractured or metafictional the narrative might be, those things are, I think, even more essential if you're going to write a deconstruction of the Haunted House novel, as, you know, I think Lunar Park attempts at times. Though I also do think that Lunar Park is almost faithful to a fault to many of those books. I mean, not to a fault, but it does mimic the structure and the slowly accumulating sense of dread that most of them do have. And that was definitely a conscious decision on my part. That wasn't something that just sort of like came, you know, out of the blue when I was working on page 100.
The one thing that it refuses is the happy ending.
Well, again, to me, the most potent and the best novels and stories like this didn't have one, that the happy ending kind of wiped away all of the fear and all of the anxiety that that the preceding story or novel or movie supplied you with, and that the things that I liked the most were, you know, the books that left things a little bit more unanswered and that were much more ambiguous, and or either just end it with a flat out, you know, shock to the system. But I don't know, a happy ending to a horror book seems to undercut everything that the writer had been working toward if it really wants to be effective.
One of my favorites is the ending of 13 Ghosts, where the little boy realizes, in fact, almost immediately that he's going to miss the ghosts now that they're gone. And the last shot is all of those spooks that you only see through the special X-ray specs all coming back on screen, the transparent lion and the ghostly headless ringmaster. They're the friends of the boy.
Yeah, I remember that ending. I liked that ending a lot. But I also liked, you know, I remember other endings to other movies that weren't necessarily supernatural where ghosts were involved that I always found really moving. I mean, it's so sentimental, but I don't know why the ending to Places in the Heart, this Robert Benton movie from 1984 with Sally Field, it ends where all of the evil people over this course of 3 years of watching this small town in Depression-era, I guess, Texas, filled with a lot of nasty people who are constantly trying to undercut Sally Field, who's lost her husband, et cetera, et cetera. And the movie ends in a church where, as a camera does this one-take pan across all the pews, it's filled with a lot of the characters, the bad characters, the Ku Klux Klan members and kind of evil priests, et cetera, are all, you know, in the same room praying together. I don't know why that, but there's something about the idea of forgiveness and that these people, no matter who they are, no matter how badly they've treated us, will in a sense always be with us as long as we're conscious, is something that is definitely at play in Lunar Park.
I've been speaking with Bret Easton Ellis, author most recently of Lunar Park, published by Knopf. Thank you, Bret, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the...
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.